Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen engagement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is India Foreign Policy, and today's guest is Aparna Bonde. Aparna is a research fellow at the Hudson Institute's Center on Islam, Democracy, and the Future of the Muslim World. Aparna wrote her PhD dissertation on Pakistan's foreign policy. Her major field of interest is South Asia, with a special focus on India, Pakistan, foreign policy, security studies, religion and politics, and political Islam. Aparna contributes to online newspapers such as The Weekly Standard, Huffington Post, Pajamas Media, IndoLink, Outlook India, and Chalk. In 1993, graduated at Delhi University. Aparna holds a Master of Arts in History from St. Stephen's College at Delhi University and a Master of Philosophy in International Relations from Jawaharlal Nehru University. Right? Yes. Aparna Bonde received a doctorate in political science from Boston University. Aparna's book titled Explaining Pakistan's Foreign Policy, Escaping India, was released March 2011 by Routledge. Please help me welcome Aparna.
Thanks, Lisa. Hello. Thank you very much, Lisa and everybody else, for inviting and arranging this talk at Hinckley. I've just spent, I think, slightly over two hours in your city, and I love it, I guess mainly because of the mountains and the snow-capped mountains. Haven't seen them in a really long time, since I've been living in D.C. for some time now, and even Boston. So I saw snow in Boston, but not as much as this. I will speak for around 20 minutes, and then I'd much rather spend the rest of my time answering questions, as I prefer that style of interaction. I will start with a brief overview of the key drivers of India's foreign policy, and then I'll move on to India's ties with some of its neighbors, then China and India-US relations. The foreign policy of a country is influenced by both its geography and history. India's foreign policy has been framed by the view that it was an old civilization, and since it was multi-ethnic, multi-religious, there was a need to be inclusive and secular. The colonial legacy and partition, including the assassination of India's founding father, ensured that secularism and pluralism were entrenched by the constitution and framed India's foreign policy. The desire to maintain unity and security meant that for India, even 66 years later, the most important relationships are those with its immediate neighbors. India's first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, was the prime minister for 17 years and also India's first foreign minister. And he laid the underlying principles for India's foreign policy. And by and large, these have remained unchanged over the last six decades. Among the key principle is the belief that India was a great civilization and is a great future power. This rests on the notion that India's geographical size, demographic size, and natural resources and location guarantee India's place in the world arena. This belief in India's status as a great civilization also led to the other notion, which is that India could teach the world more with a non-assertive, non-aggressive, soft power approach. And this belief that India can lead by example again is still very prevalent in India's foreign policy. The legacy of almost 200 years of colonial rule meant that at independence in 1947, Indian leaders were desirous of building India's economic strength. And therefore, there was an emphasis on economic self-sufficiency, avoiding reliance on outside powers. The legacy of colonial rule also meant that India wanted to avoid military alliances, not be part of any of the blocs, and therefore stay out of the Cold War as much as possible. Again, part of the fact that there was colonial rule and therefore the military was very dominant during the colonial times meant that at independence and since then, the Indian military has been under civilian control. These principles defined India's strategic goals. And the main goals are ensure national economic development, secure India's immediate neighborhood and periphery. And when I say neighborhood, I'm for India and India's planners, it means not just South Asia, where India is located, but the region from the east coast of Africa and the Middle East right through Southeast Asia. And part of this is to plays into the fact that India would like to have a role in the security and economic architecture of this region, both the Middle East as well as the Asia-Pacific region, for security reasons, for energy reasons, for economic reasons. Now I'll turn to India's ties with some of its neighbors in order to explain this. If we look at India's neighbors, India's policy towards them has been based on two main principles, I'd say. One, there's a belief by the majority of Indian leaders and policymakers that the entire Indian subcontinent shares a common history, civilization, and that these alone, these shared interests, should help build better ties. It has not always been viewed the same way by the neighbors, who often perceive India as a big brother, and there are conflicts and tensions. Secondly, for India, its neighbors are its security and its first line of protection, security, and therefore, India has let's put it this way, for India, the presence of an external power in the south, in the Indian subcontinent is something India has never been very accepting of, unless that external power, for example, whether it be China, whether it be Soviet Union, now Russia, United States, if India and that external power have good relations, India is fine with the presence of the external power. Otherwise, it is not, because then it sees the external power as trying to negate Indian predominance in the region. If we turn to India's largest neighbor, immediate neighbor, Pakistan. As Lisa mentioned, I wrote my dissertation on my PhD dissertation on Pakistan's foreign policy. And the title I gave to my book was Escaping India, and there was a deliberate reason why I gave that title. It's because I believe that at the core of India-Pakistan tensions, problems, conflicts, lies identity and a trust deficit. The trust deficit and identity date back to before the two countries were created, the 1920s and 30s. Pakistan's identity and its foreign policy is India-centric. In the sense that I said, I mean, for most of the last six decades, Pakistan has been trying to escape India, both geographically. So you'll find Pakistani leaders saying Pakistan is Middle East, is a Middle Eastern country, or is part of the Middle East, even though Pakistan is South Asian. And that's an attempt to avoid or escape a region where India is predominant. That plays into its identity where religion or Islam is emphasized. Even though, and I often mention this, most people do not realize that India, Pakistan, Bangladesh have almost the same number of Muslims. So it's not as though India has fewer Muslims than Pakistan does. And the other driver of Pakistan's foreign policy and India-Pakistan relations has been a desire to achieve parity. I don't mean sovereign equality. Every nation has sovereign equality. The question is, are you equal to or are you the same size as another country? And so parity, this desire for parity by Pakistan has been mainly in the military arena, so conventional military parity, nuclear parity, but even economic and other arenas. And this plays out in the relations between the two countries. I'll just briefly mention the areas of conflict, and I'd be happy to discuss the details in the Q&A. Kashmir, I'm sure almost all of you have heard of the name. There's a Kashmir dispute between the two countries. There is a water dispute. There's also the issue of what both countries refer to as terrorism, or the use by Pakistan's mainly military and intelligence apparatus to have proxies, mainly radical Islamist groups, which can be used as proxies in Afghanistan and India. Afghanistan, I'll touch on in a little while. On the positive side, the two countries have a lot in common. I mean, they can become US and Canada at some stage. They can also become France and Germany at some stage. The question is, how many decades? There's tremendous trade potential. And so the aim of academics and aim of analysts mainly is to hope that something like this will happen. Not necessarily in the immediate future, but it's a possibility. I mentioned Afghanistan. Afghanistan's relations with Pakistan and India have often been affected by India-Pakistan relations. And the reason is that, and this comes back to India-Pakistan relations and the tension between the two countries, Afghanistan has often been perceived by Pakistan as a country which would help it against India, as maybe a buffer zone, as a territory which it could use. And from India's point of view, if there's a friendly Afghanistan, then India does not have to worry about Afghan territory being used by Pakistan. And in this, I will give you examples of the fact that the current day Afghan Taliban are based in Afghanistan, the remnants of the old Mujahideen groups, the fact that Afghan territory was used to shelter and to have training camps for terror groups which focused on India, on Central Asia, on even Iran. For India, Afghanistan, as I said, has a security dimension to it. There's also an economic dimension, which is that India wants access to Central Asian markets and energy resources. And the only way India can access Central Asia is through Afghanistan and Pakistan, or through Iran and Afghanistan. India is the largest regional donor to Afghanistan currently, around $2 billion in aid for Afghan reconstruction and rehabilitation. So for India, Afghan stability is important, and a non-Taliban Afghanistan is important. If we turn to the East, I'd say, India-Bangladesh relations. There's a border dispute which is more or less resolved. However, India's problems with But Bangladesh kind of mirror those with Pakistan, which is that slight border dispute. There's a water issue. And then I'm sure most of you have seen the map of India. India's northeast borders Bangladesh. And the easiest way to access India's northeast is via Bangladesh, which is impossible. And so for India, it's a security dimension, but it's also getting access to its own territory. There have also been some insurgent groups in India's northeast, and for some time they received refuge as well as aid from Bangladesh. That has ceased in the last decade, but India still has that semi-insurgency going on in the northeast. India provides a lot of economic aid, infrastructure, development assistance, emergency natural disaster assistance to Bangladesh. Bangladesh, like Pakistan, went through a couple of decades of military rule. It's now settling into democracy, but it's still not as well settled as one would like it to be. To India's north is the country which Indian analysts believe is the main threat to India, which is China. And for that reason, the country which comes in between the two is important, Nepal. It's important because it's India's buffer. It's important because a large number of Indian rivers flow from Nepal into India. So India gets water, India gets hydroelectric power from Nepal. Nepal is also the only neighbor of India which has an open border with India. So there's no passport. It's kind of like US-Canada. You can cross without a passport, without a visa. You can work, live, study. There are no visa restrictions. But because of the conflicts in the neighborhood, it's also a security dimension, because anybody can come into Nepal and from there cross the border into India, and vice versa. The other aspect of the relationship with Nepal is that Nepal for decades was a monarchy. And it's only recently that it's become a democracy, and it still has problems, mainly because of the fact that the largest political party right now, which has grassroots support, are the Maoists. And they have support, both ideological as well as other, from China. And part of India's fear is that if the Maoists come to power in Nepal, it's going to have an impact on India and on Indian domestic politics also. Turning to India's southern neighbor, Sri Lanka. There the issue is tied to what is referred to as the Tamil question. Sri Lanka is a Sinhalese majority country which has a very large Tamil minority. Now, Tamils are a large ethno-linguistic group which are there as a minority in Sri Lanka, but they're a very large number in the southernmost state of India. Most of the Tamils in Sri Lanka went there over centuries, even though many of them also went there during British colonial rule. And there's been a civil war ongoing in Sri Lanka for almost 2-3 decades. It just finished a couple of years ago, and now there's a process of rehabilitation, reconstruction in Sri Lanka. But for India, this problem is both foreign policy, ties with the neighbor, and domestic politics. Because because whatever happens in Sri Lanka impacts the state of Tamil Nadu, and that impacts domestic politics, and therefore impacts federal-state relations and impacts foreign policy. Sri Lanka is also important because Sri Lanka is India's access to the Indian Ocean, access for economy, access for energy. Most of India's oil and gas come from the Persian Gulf. And so the access to the sea lines of communication. It's India's naval presence is also impacted by Sri Lanka and Sri Lanka's navy. And finally, China's relationship with Sri Lanka impacts India's security. And so if China has increased presence in Sri Lanka, it will make a difference to how India perceives its own security in the region. Since I've spoken so much about China, I might as well talk a little bit about India-China ties. In the initial decade after independence, let's say till the mid-1950s, India-China had very good ties. India's leaders saw China and India as the two nations in Asia which were going to dominate and which would be friendly with each other. However, the two have a border dispute, which dates back to the way the maps and the boundaries were drawn during the British times. And neither country agrees on where the boundary line should be drawn. They fought a war in 1962, which India lost. And ever since, for Indian strategists, for Indian leaders and policymakers, it's China which is the threat. And so Indian strategy, military, nuclear is all geared towards China, not towards Pakistan. It's geared towards China. So India's nuclear, the reason why India has nuclear weapons is because India fears what will happen, what if there's a war with China. The two have, as I mentioned, a border dispute, and for decades they had barely any economic ties. However, in the 1990s, things changed. And today, China is one of India's top trading partners. Their bilateral trade comes to around $55 billion a year. And so, in the economic arena, ties are better. The border dispute still continues. And despite dozens of talks and discussions and agreements, the border dispute still remains. Final part of this is the issue of Tibet. India recognizes Tibet as being part of China. However, India also gave refuge to the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan government in exile and thousands of Tibetan refugees. And that is part of the dispute that China is not very accepting of the fact that India has allowed the Dalai Lama, the Prime Minister in exile, and Tibetan refugees to live in India and therefore to be able to travel to protest against the Chinese occupation. Lastly, China has, especially in the last two decades, built really good ties with all of India's neighbors, immediate neighbors. With Pakistan, China has military and very close nuclear ties. With Nepal, with Bangladesh, with Sri Lanka. And Indian strategists call this China's string of pearls theory. Basically try to encircle a country by having ties with all the neighbors. India's response, by and large, has been one, to build better ties with its neighbors, and two, to look east and start building ties with countries in Southeast Asia and in East Asia. So India's ties with Japan, South Korea, basically all of China's neighbors for security as well as economic reasons. I'll turn to the United States now and talk about India-US ties. The United States provided support and actually supported the Indian independence movement in the 1940s. President FDR supported the Indian independence movement, and his government and he especially tried to convince the British government and Prime Minister Churchill to give India independence before the Second World War. And the first U.S. let's say, government representative, was sent to India in 1941. However, Cold War, the fact that India did not want to join the Cold War, be part of it, or join any military alliance, the fact that India's first prime minister was reluctant to be part of any bloc, and that he had he himself had Fabian socialist views, led to the led to India-US being, for lack of a better word, I'll use what an American diplomat used in his book, estranged. That the two countries never saw each other as a threat, but were never allies or friends, right till almost the 1990s. It's only in the 1990s that things changed, starting with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the fact that therefore India no longer had, for decades the Soviet Union provided India military equipment and also economic support. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, India had a problem. And finally, India had an internal economic crisis in the early 1990s, which led India to open up its economy, no longer be a mixed economy, but be a free market economy, have liberalization, and also change its foreign policy, starting with from the time of President Bill Clinton right till today. The India-US ties have improved. They're economic. US is among India's top trading partners, almost, I think, $60 billion a year. Plus, there are other aspects of the relationship. One is cultural and people-to-people. About 100,000 Indian students come to the US to study on an annual basis. There are about, I think, over 3 million Indian Americans in this country. Both countries are democracies. They believe in pluralism and secularism. Both view threats like terrorism to be threats which impact them and impact the globe. To some extent, while both of them have good ties with China, there's also a fear of what will happen in the future. And so there's been a growing, not just economic, but also, let's say, security and military dimension to the relationship. In 2006, 2008, India-US signed the civil nuclear deal. They have annual military exercises, defense trade, counterterrorism cooperation. Both seek a stable, peaceful Afghanistan and Pakistan. Cyber security. So there are a number of areas, and so on an annual basis now, the two have what's known as the US-India Strategic Dialogue to discuss everything from economy and education and energy to defense and security. I will stop now, and I'd be happy to take any questions which people have.
If you have a question, just stand up and raise your hand, or just raise your hand, and then when I bring you the mic, stand up and say your name and your question. Okay, well, I have a question. I know that in the beginning of India's independence, their conflict with Pakistan was it was based over a lot of religious conflict in Kashmir, and how much of the population was Muslim, but the leader was Hindu.
Yeah.
Do you think the conflict, because I wanted to go to Kashmir this summer and I couldn't because there was so much conflict. Do you think the conflict is still religiously based, or is it more of a political thing now? Has it shifted?
I mean, let's put it this way. When Kashmir started, when the Kashmir dispute started, mainly because when the British Indian Empire was ended and partition took place, partition was... there were two parts of the British Empire. One was what is known as the British Indian provinces. So they were divided between India and Pakistan depending on Muslim majority, Hindu majority. Then there were the princely states, about 560 in total, but some of them were like as small as a city was and some were as big as Kashmir is. These states were allowed to decide which of the two countries they wanted to join. The conditions laid down were two. One, that they had to be geographically or territorially contiguous, means you either had to be in that country or you had to be next to the country to join it. And the second was what the people wanted, but what the people wanted could obviously only be expressed by the ruler at that time. There were only three princely states where the problem came up, and I'll only talk about Kashmir right now. Main problem being that it was contiguous to both India and Pakistan, so it could choose either. Second was that it was a Muslim majority state, but ruled by a Hindu Maharaja. He didn't want to join either. He wanted to be Switzerland. He wanted to be neutral and be independent. Unfortunately, both countries wanted Kashmir. India, Pakistan sent in its troops in 1947. The Maharaja, the ruler, appealed to India for help, and India sent in its troops. So the current border, boundary, de facto line of control, as it's called, is where the two troops were facing each other when the UN announced ceasefire. Now, I believe that in 1947, if Pakistan had waited a little while, it would have got Kashmir, because most of the routes were through Kashmir, it was Muslim majority, maybe in a year or two it would have joined, and things would have been fine. But when you force an issue and becomes military, and then each country decided that they had to justify Pakistan. So for India, it's a secular country, and therefore a Muslim majority province being part of India justifies India being secular. And for Pakistan, I don't know how many of you know, but the word Pakistan itself, literally it translates into land of the pure. But Pakistan, the word comes from Punjab, Afghania, Kashmir, Sindh, and Balochistan, the provinces which became part of Pakistan. So if K is in Pakistan, then why isn't Kashmir part of Pakistan? So it's an identity issue. And the problem which has happened is that even if territory which you have is one you may not want very much, or it doesn't have much resources on it, you'll still keep it. There's no state in this world which will give up territory just like that. We still live in a world where states hold on to territories. And when territory and identity are combined, states don't give that up. So for both countries, it's territory and identity. It's not, the issue per se is not religious. And the reason is both countries have the same number of Muslims. So it's not a question of, Pakistan portrays it as that because that's, as I said, an identity issue, and India doesn't portray it. But the question is more of, I would say, a question of trust. And I say this often, that, you know, if I trust Lisa, you don't have to write a contract. I'll believe that you'll do what you say. But if I don't trust you, you can write 100 contracts and I still won't believe you. So I believe Kashmir can be resolved, but it can only be resolved when the two countries start trusting each other, in the sense of allowing trade, allowing people-to-people ties, allowing more border movement, allowing people to go to different parts of India. I'm an Indian. So therefore, it's almost impossible for me to get a visa to Pakistan. And when I do, I can go to only 3 cities, and I have to do police verification in every city. It's the same for a Pakistani coming to India. I wrote my dissertation in Pakistan. It took me 6 months to get a visa to go there. So if those are the restrictions you place, then how will the two countries ever understand each other or go beyond or sort of start resolving issues? Questions? I put people to sleep?
Don't meet me halfway.
Yeah. I don't know how far this the wire will go.
Hi, my name is Mark. And I was wondering, what with China's influence in the region, what is the likelihood that America will actually have a base in India to help counter the influence of China?
I don't think you mean the old style bases, right?
No.
We're talking about, it's just to some extent, it's been there always, in the sense that from the time of the Second World War and the start of the Cold War, A large part of the reason why many American strategists wanted better ties with India or wanted a united India and not partition not to take place was because they felt that if India partitioned, then the British Indian Army, which was so well trained and had been used in the First and Second World War, wouldn't be available to fight against Soviet Union or against Communist China once China became communist. And part of the of U.S. ties with Pakistan goes into that. And the problem there has been that U.S. has provided aid to Pakistan, military mainly, but even economic, throughout the Cold War to counter communism, the communist threat. But for Pakistan, it was the threat was never communism. The threat was always India. And Pakistan had very good ties with China, right from the 1950s. So they never, U.S. was never able to use Pakistan against China. And actually, in 1971, Pakistan helped the famous Kissinger visit to Beijing was via Pakistan. Even the 60s, President Kennedy felt that ties with India would actually help have a country which is an ally against China. Now, there are people, that there are strategists here who believe India can do that role, play that role. There are Indians who believe that India can play that role. Because for India, China is the threat. Pakistan is not a threat per se. It's China which is a threat. But there are others who are also worried that, one, it'll mean moving away from the non-aligned posture of India, which was that India doesn't want to have alliances or treaties with any country. Secondly, is the argument that India is right next door to China, US is very far away. So if China decides to strike, it will be India which gets hit first. And in that case, will there be an American umbrella or not? And if there isn't, then why would India do something unless it was assured that if something happens, U.S. would come in, like with the European countries or with Japan in Korea or Taiwan. I mean, Indian strategies, Indian leaders would want to be assured that we rank as high as that if we go forward with something like that. So it could, but as I said, it depends on how the U.S.-India relationship builds out and how much, in the last few years, what I've started to see is a growing isolationism within the U.S., a desire to talk more about domestic policy, politics, economy, the global economic crisis, and the desire not to be involved in the world to the extent possible. If that is so, then India will be even more reluctant. Because if U.S. is going to avoid playing a role in most parts of the world, then India does not want to stick its neck out. Questions? Comments?
No more questions? Okay, thank you all so much, and help me thank our guest.
Thank you.
Thank you.